So, out of 196 countries on Earth, how many do you think actually offer women full legal equality with men? Like, just take a guess. 100. 50.
You'd think it would be a lot, right?
Right. I mean, you really would. But according to a 2023 World Bank report, that number is exactly 14.
Wow. Just 14.
Yeah, literally 14 countries where the law doesn't differentiate based on gender for things like pay or access to justice or protection from violence.
That is just, I mean, it's a profoundly jarring number when you first hear it. It completely shares this, this comforting narrative we've kind of built for ourselves over the last few decades.
It really does. We treat gender equality like it's this done deal, like it's just a box we checked off somewhere in the late 20th century, and now we're just sweeping up the leftover crumbs. But
Right, so.
today we're going completely past that surface level assumption.
Absolutely.
Welcome to today's deep dive. We are looking at this really eye-opening educational course by Hess et al., and it's titled The Illusion of Equality: Navigating Modern Gender Systems.
And it is a fascinating source.
It really is. So our mission today is to examine the invisible structures, the historical biases, and the hard data that show exactly why having legal equality on paper rarely translates to lived equality in practice.
Right, because that disconnect is crucial. I mean, even if you happen to live in one of those 14 countries with full legal equality, a change in legislation doesn't just automatically rewire centuries of human behavior,
Yeah,
It
totally.
doesn't instantly redesign the physical and social systems we operate in every single day.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because before we can really look at how inequality manifests today, we have to talk about the underlying architecture of our modern world. The course refers to the system as patriarchy.
Which is a loaded word for a lot of people.
It is, yeah. Now, for those of you listening who follow sociology or history, that's obviously a familiar term. But the course defines it neutrally, representing this historical structure where power, influence, and authority have historically been held by men, and male-associated traits are just valued higher.
What's fascinating here is how the course makes that abstract architecture highly visible. They use this flip it thought experiment.
Oh, I loved this part.
Right. It's so good. They ask you to imagine a world where, for the last 1,000 years, women held almost all positions of power. Just imagine governments, religions, legal systems, financial institutions, media empires.
Basically, everything running the world.
Exactly. Completely designed and run by women.
And crucially, all the foundational texts and laws would have been written by women, based entirely on female biology and female life experiences as the universal default.
Think about what that would do to cultural norms. In that flipped world, even if everyone today woke up with the absolute purest intentions of total equality, that centuries-long imbalance would have cemented a specific baseline.
Right, like the starting line is totally skewed.
Exactly. Men in that society would likely be viewed as, I don't know, too aggressive, or maybe too biologically chaotic and emotionally volatile to be trusted with high-stakes leadership.
Because they wouldn't fit the established norm.
Right. It demonstrates that our current system isn't just a matter of individual prejudice. It's about how the historical concentration of power dictates what society considers normal, rational, and standard. Power shapes the default.
The analogy that popped into my head while reading that section is, well, it's like moving into an old house that you didn't build. You might not be personally responsible for the weird, outdated floor plan that makes some rooms freezing and others boiling, but you still have to navigate it every single day. You're living inside the architecture of the past.
I love that. Actually, I'd take that analogy even further.
Oh.
Yeah, you aren't just living in a house with a weird floor plan. It's a floor plan where all the thermostats are located in the men's rooms.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So they get to set the temperature to whatever is comfortable for them, while the women are essentially expected to just, put on a sweater and adapt.
And the data from the source shows exactly how much adapting is happening right now. Globally, women perform around 75% of all unpaid care and domestic work.
75%.
Yeah. Cooking, cleaning, childcare, elder care, emotional labor. Plus, women earn 20% less than men worldwide.
And those two statistics are inextricably linked. I mean, the expectation of unpaid labor completely limits the time and energy women can invest in paid labor or career advancement.
Right.
But because that unpaid domestic work is viewed socially as the natural role for women, it remains entirely invisible and undervalued.
Which brings up a really perfect example from the course material, the standard 9-to-5 workday.
Yes, the workday schedule.
Right, because the 9-to-5 schedule was designed during an era when it was just assumed that the person going to the office had a spouse at home handling literally everything else.
Yeah, yeah.
The cooking, the cleaning, the doctor's appointments, the school pickups.
It was a system built for a single-income household relying on free domestic labor. But now, fast forward to today, we tell women, hey, you have equal rights to enter the workforce.
Welcome to the office.
Right. But we haven't actually changed the architecture of the workday. So women enter this professional system that fundamentally clashes with the 75% of unpaid labor they are still expected to perform. They are participating in a system that was secretly built for someone else.
That friction is everywhere. And, you know, if society treats women's domestic labor as this invisible baseline, it treats their physical bodies the exact same way. I want to transition from domestic life to the institutional level, specifically looking at healthcare.
Oh, this is a huge part of the course.
Yeah, because we generally assume medicine is purely objective, right?
Right.
That it's rooted in hard science and therefore it's perfectly neutral.
Right. We assume illness affects human beings, so healthcare must be designed for all human beings.
Yeah.
But historically, medical science has operated under the assumption that the male body is the default human body.
And the female body is?
Is essentially just a smaller male body with reproductive organs attached.
But wait, I have to play devil's advocate here based on the text, because I look at the history of clinical trials and I always assumed women were excluded to protect them, especially regarding potential pregnancies or, you know, fetal development complications. Wasn't that exclusion well-intentioned?
That was absolutely the prevailing justification.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the source explains that following tragedies like the thalidomide crisis in the mid-20th century, there was this massive push to protect women of childbearing age from experimental risks.
Which makes sense on the surface.
Exactly. However, the mechanism of that protection had disastrous downstream effects.
Yeah.
By excluding women from phase one and phase two clinical trials, the medical establishment essentially cemented the 70-kilogram male as the universal biological standard.
Meaning everything from drug efficacy to side effects was calibrated to a male metabolism.
Yes. Because men and women metabolize drugs differently. They have different fat distributions, different kidney functions, hormonal fluctuations.
Buy it.
So when you calculate a dosage based entirely on a male cohort and then prescribe that identical dosage to women, you end up with massive discrepancies in adverse side effects.
And when those side effects appear, or when women present with symptoms that just don't match the textbook male standard, what happens?
The symptoms get dismissed.
Exactly. The source material outlines how frequently women's pain is misdiagnosed or written off as anxiety, stress, or just being hormonal.
It creates this awful feedback loop. The medical system doesn't study the female body adequately, so it doesn't recognize female-specific symptoms. And because it doesn't recognize the symptoms, doctors assume the issue is psychological rather than physical.
And nowhere is this discrepancy more glaring than in reproductive health. I mean, look at the history of male contraceptives. There have been several promising male birth control options that just stalled out in clinical trials. And why? Because the side effects, things like mood swings, weight gain, or headaches were deemed medically unacceptable.
Unacceptable for men. Meanwhile, those exact same side effects, and honestly, often significantly worse ones, including blood clots and severe depression, are the universally accepted standard for female contraceptives.
It's wild.
Discomfort and physical risk for women are normalized as a routine expectation. But discomfort for men is viewed as an unacceptable systemic barrier.
The double standard is just staggering, and it goes beyond just how drugs are researched. It extends into how fundamental choices are respected. The course points out the immense barriers women face when seeking voluntary sterilization.
Oh, yes.
They are frequently refused by doctors who claim they are too young, or they are asked if they have consulted their current or future partner.
Which is infuriating.
Or they're just flatly told they might change their mind.
It highlights a core inequality in bodily autonomy. The source points out that in the medical system, male autonomy, like seeking a vasectomy, is generally trusted by default. The man is presumed to be the ultimate authority on his own life and body.
But female autonomy
is treated as highly conditional. A woman is expected to continuously justify her decisions to medical authorities in ways men simply are not.
And that bias isn't contained to just medicine. The source material ties this into other objective physical systems, like automotive safety. For decades, car crash test dummies were based entirely on the 50th percentile male physique.
Which means the safety features, the seatbelts, the airbags, the headrests, were optimized to protect a male body.
Yeah.
And as a direct result, when a woman is involved in a car crash, she is statistically far more likely to be seriously injured or killed than a man in an identical crash. It is a literal manifestation of that old house metaphor you mentioned.
Right. The environment is objectively more dangerous because women literally were not factored into the original blueprint. And that leads directly to the next major point. Because if institutions like medicine and manufacturing don't prioritize a woman's physical safety or trust her account of her own body, well, society at large certainly isn't going to trust her account of her own safety in public spaces. Here's where it gets really interesting.
Okay.
The text talks about the immense mental load of physical safety that women carry every single day.
The constant low-level hum of threat assessment.
Yes. Holding keys between fingers, avoiding eye contact, parking under streetlights, taking the long way home, modifying clothing choices, constantly assessing the body language of strangers. If women are constantly forced to adjust their daily lives to anticipate and avoid danger, doesn't that essentially function as a form of invisible social control?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, that is exactly how the mechanism works. The global data in the course states that 1 in 3 women will experience physical or sexual violence in their lifetime.
1 in 3.
Right. But the impact of that violence extends far beyond the direct physical harm. It creates an atmosphere of pervasive fear. By making violence an ever-present threat, and crucially making safety the woman's personal responsibility, the system essentially forces women to police their own boundaries.
They curfew themselves.
Exactly. They limit their own economic and social opportunities out of a necessity to just stay safe. And when violence does occur, it thrives in environments that immediately pivot to victim blaming.
Like, what were you wearing?
Or why were you walking alone at night? How much did you have to drink?
Shifting the responsibility of the crime completely away from the person who actually chose to cause harm and placing the burden entirely onto the person who experienced it. It implies that if you fail to anticipate every possible risk, whatever happens is essentially your fault for poor risk management.
And we really have to examine how intersectionality plays a massive role in how this burden is distributed. Because this threat assessment and the cost of reporting violence is not the same for all women.
Right. How does the course say that compounding mechanism works in practice?
Well, think about the barriers to reporting abuse. If a middle-class white woman reports violence, she faces immense systemic skepticism, right? But if a woman of color reports that same violence, she faces the compounding effects of both sexism and systemic racism. She is statistically less likely to be believed by law enforcement or treated with urgency by the medical system.
The barriers just multiply.
Exponentially.
Yeah.
I mean, if an undocumented immigrant woman experiences domestic violence, reporting it might trigger involvement with immigration enforcement, risking deportation.
Right. The stakes are so much higher.
Exactly. For a disabled woman, reporting abuse by a caregiver means risking the loss of her daily survival support. LGBTQ plus women or women living in extreme poverty face immense layered barriers. Intersectionality determines whose pain is taken seriously, who has the social capital to be deemed a credible victim, and who is simply ignored by the system.
When the cost of reporting is that astronomically high, silence becomes the only logical survival strategy, which, again, just reinforces that invisible social control.
Precisely.
Now, whenever we discuss systemic gender disadvantage, there is a very vocal reaction that always comes up. And, you know, it's a valid observation. People point out that men experience massive inequality and suffering as well.
Yes, they do.
I mean, look at the history of the military draft in this source. Historically, men are the ones forced by governments to go to war, to face extreme trauma, to literally die on the battlefield. They suffer a literal loss of bodily autonomy. So doesn't that look like a system that actively disadvantages men?
This raises an important question. And the course explores the historical mechanics of it really deeply.
Right.
Because the material does not deny that men suffer tremendously. They absolutely do. They face higher rates of workplace fatalities, immense pressure to suppress vulnerability, and severe disadvantages based on class or race.
Right. Nobody is denying that.
Exactly. But the source makes a vital distinction here. Men suffer under patriarchy, not despite it.
Okay, walk me through the mechanics of that, specifically regarding the draft.
Okay, let's look at the timeline and context of historical conscription laws. In the 19th and early 20th centuries, when these draft systems were really formalized, who was writing the laws?
Well, men.
Right. It was entirely male-dominated governments, military generals, and lawmakers. This was happening during areas when women couldn't vote, couldn't hold political office, and had zero input in national defense strategy.
So the architects of the violence were men.
Yes. And we have to ask why those male lawmakers excluded women from the draft. It wasn't out of some benevolent desire to coddle them. It was deeply rooted in the belief that women were physically frail, emotionally unstable, and intellectually incapable of the serious work of warfare and statecraft.
Their utility to the state was strictly relegated to, like, domesticity and biological reproduction.
Exactly. While men were viewed as strong, rational, and dominant. But the flip side of being viewed as strong and dominant is that you are also viewed as expendable for the sake of violence. It is the exact same rigid hierarchy assigning extremely narrow roles to everyone. The system values men only for their utility in conflict and labor, completely stripping them of their right to vulnerability. Meanwhile, it completely strips women of their agency and access to power.
It's just two sides of the exact same coin. The course makes it very clear that this isn't a competition of suffering.
No, not at all.
It's not about keeping score of who has it worse. It's about recognizing that men and women are experiencing different forms of harm stemming from the exact same structural rules.
Under this architecture, nobody actually wins. Men are harmed by the crushing expectation of dominance and emotional suppression, and women are harmed by the expectation of submission and endless adaptation. A rigid set of rules that dictates your humanity and your social value entirely based on your gender hurts everyone, even if men historically benefit more from the concentration of power at the top of that system.
So, what does this all mean? We've covered a massive amount of ground today diving into this HESSL course. We started with this comforting illusion that equality is just a legal finish line we crossed decades ago. But looking at the mechanisms from the 75% of unpaid labor to medical dosages based on male metabolisms to the mental load of self-policing in public spaces, we see that legal equality is very different from lived reality.
Because a law on a piece of paper cannot automatically redesign a world that was physically and socially constructed over centuries to favor one specific group. And as the source warns, rights do not protect themselves.
Yeah, that's a crucial point.
If we don't understand the mechanisms of these invisible systems, the progress we have made can easily be stalled or quietly rolled back.
And for you listening, why does this deep dive matter for your everyday life? Because once you understand how these mechanisms actually work, you stop seeing unfairness as just the way things are. You can spot the bias in the 9-to-5 schedule. You can recognize why certain symptoms are dismissed at the doctor's office. You can challenge your own absorbed assumptions and actively contribute to building fairer workplaces and communities.
To close this out, the source material features a brilliant matching activity focused on unintended consequences.
Oh, this was great.
It pairs seemingly neutral, everyday things like office climate control, standard workday cycles, or even the dimensions of a smartphone with the hidden biases of their original design.
It really forces you to look at your environment differently.
It does. So we want to leave you with this final thought. Tomorrow, look closely at the physical and social world around you. Look at the temperature of your office building. Look at the safety features in your car. Look at the division of invisible tasks in your own home. And ask yourself, was this system actually designed with everyone in mind, or am I just spending my entire life adapting to a world that was secretly built for someone else?
Are you just trying to stay warm in a house with a floor plan you didn't design? Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the architecture around you.